I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You've just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
You're listening to a Frequency Podcast Network production.
So, the weather was bad this week in North America.
Storm surges upwards of 15 to 16 feet, 20 inches of rain or more.
Ida crippling a massive power grid. Today, the energy provider saying it could take 3 weeks before hard-hit areas are back up.
Hurricane Ida, while so far not nearly as deadly as Katrina, has devastated the power and water infrastructure of the Gulf Coast. This is an area that, you know, has a fair bit of practice preparing for these kinds of storms. But maybe not for these kinds of storms this often. Meanwhile, in California, a place that does have plenty of experience handling wildfires, firefighters battled with everything they had to keep Lake Tahoe from burning. California firefighters are some of the best on the planet at this kind of thing. But even they can't save everything when about half the state is on fire. And in New York City, a place that, okay, well, they're not known for any specific sort of natural disaster. And maybe that's why, when Ida arrived as a tropical storm, they were hit with a flood. A flood is the precise kind of disaster that cities that normally think themselves safe from disasters get hammered by.
For the first time in recorded history, the National Weather Service issuing a flash flood emergency for all five boroughs of New York City. More than 7 inches of rain in just a few hours. The Western Hemisphere's busiest subway system shut down.
So besides the obvious, climate change, what do these events have in common? They illustrate how unprepared cities and infrastructure and services in general are for the era we're already living in. Events like these are going to hit all of our cities in some form or another, and we need to be ready when they do. And in Canada and the United States, mostly we are not. But there are places we can learn from, strategies we can employ, and most importantly, long-term benefits we can reap if we can somehow get our act together and adapt our cities to the present. Will we? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is The Big Story. Alex Steffen is an award-winning writer, speaker, and foresight consultant. You can find him at alexsteffen.com, and you can find his fantastic newsletter, The Nearly Now, at thenearlynow.com. Hi, Alex.
Hi, nice to be here.
It's so great to have you. I wish we had a less depressing topic to discuss today, but I'm sure you're used to that.
It's my job.
Before we get to the hopeful stuff, which I swear we will get to, let's begin with what we're seeing in the aftermath of Hurricane Ida. I mean, the footage we're seeing and what we're hearing about how long people are going to be without power and just how crushed the infrastructure is down there, this is an area that should be ready for these kind of storms, and it seems completely devastated. What happened?
Well, there are sort of two answers. One is that there are limits to adaptation, right? There are limits to the extent to which we can prepare ourselves for changes stemming from climate change and ecological degradation. And the second is that we do not allocate our funds and energies in the world in the most logical way. And especially when it comes to poor people and poor communities, we don't tend to do the investments that we really ought to be doing to prepare ourselves. You know, and this goes to this question of tolerances, that the entire built world, right, everything we've ever built, was built with an expectation that the world around it would function in certain ways. And it was built to tolerances, right? So we hear about like the 100-year floodplain, the 500-year floodplain, right? These ideas that in 100 years, you would see a storm bad enough to flood this area, right? In 500 years, you'd see one storm bad enough to flood that area. Well, those tolerances no longer reflect the operations of the planet around us, because we've changed the operations of the planet around us, you know, in massive ways, not just in terms of changing the climate, of course, but also in terms of changing hydrology, in terms of, you know, deforesting areas that used to absorb water, of, you know, failing to allow silt to replenish the delta in front of New Orleans, for example, after building all these sort of dams and canals and so forth. So it's a very complex problem, but it comes down to this challenge of what do you do when the world around you, the world you've built, is no longer ready for the planet we've made.
Is there a world in which, after Katrina struck, we realized the impact of the oncoming changes to climate and adapted? New Orleans, just to use an example, I know there are a lot of other Gulf Coast cities devastated right now, but, you know, is there a world in which we could have done that and made this city better able to weather the storm? And what would that world look like?
Well, personally, I believe absolutely there's a world in which we could have done that. It would have started by minimizing the chaos we face, right? That we are still making the planetary crisis worse every single day. And had we begun 10, 20, 30 years ago, when we knew this was a serious problem and we knew what to do about it, had we begun dramatically cutting carbon emissions, reducing toxics, you know, preserving ecosystems and so forth, then we would be facing a much less serious problem now. Similarly, the best thing we can do to protect things in the future is to take those actions now so that the crisis doesn't get even worse. Mm-hmm. One way to think about this is places that are subject to sudden collapse because of climate and ecological factors are brittle, right? And brittleness grows the more the chaos in the system grows. And that's what we're doing, is we're inducing a massive amount of chaos. So the first part of the question is, we should have, first of all, started when we knew we needed to start. And second of all, start now and really make these drastic kinds of cuts to emissions and stuff we need. But the second part of the question is, how do we prepare, right? How do we prepare a city like New Orleans, for example, for what's coming? And I don't want to blame any of the parties involved with the, you know, the building of the New Orleans we actually have on the ground today, because this is really tough stuff to do, and it's a moving target. What we believed would be the worst case scenario, or the likely worst case scenario, you know, not that long ago, is where we're already, you know, living, and then some. You know, we just saw Ida, for example, you know, greatly like pick up a head of steam as it came in towards the coast, because the water in the Gulf was so warm that it provided a lot of energy to that storm. Right, that's not a normal storm. That's a climate driven monster, and we're seeing more and more of these things. You know, I live here in California, where we're seeing fires that are behaving in ways that fires have never behaved. For example, burning over the crest of the Sierra, over barren ground, and burning forests on the other side of the mountains. Right, and in that circumstance, what we should have done to prepare is, you know, it's a difficult call, because, you know, as we've seen, there was a lot of work in New Orleans. There was a lot of effort to, you know, build back better levees and so forth. And even with that work, right, we're seeing a lot of destruction. It's not as bad as it could have been. There's a lot less loss of life than some people feared, and so forth. But every place on Earth has its disaster coming for it. You know, New Orleans just got its Ida, and it will probably get more storms in the future, more problems, right? But every place has its Ida, you know? Every place on Earth is now much more vulnerable to, you know, to disaster and upheaval than it was before, right? There's no place that's safe. There are places that are less endangered than others, and there are some places that are so endangered, we have to ask whether it's worth pouring in the massive amount of money it would take to save them, right? But we have to take seriously that this is no longer an issue, but an era, right? That this is no longer a thing that you do as well as you do all these other things in your city, but rather we now live in an era where the success of cities is defined by how well they are preparing for the reality we now live in.
I'm glad you raised that point, because I wanted to talk about normal cities for a moment. And by that, I just mean ones that are not like New Orleans or parts of Florida, you know, planning for natural disaster X because it comes at a reasonable interval every few years or whatever. I'm talking about my city, for instance, Toronto, where I live. We don't really get natural disasters. We might have some flooding, but we've seen a massive shift in what our summers look like and our rain looks like and how prepared are most typical big cities for not the natural disasters, but the everyday impacts of a different climate?
The answer in North America is that no city I know of could be considered well-prepared. The more northerly you go, the farther away from the coast you go, right? The more places that are not yet in general experiencing sort of, you know, disastrous consequences. But, you know, just this summer, we saw a deadly heat wave in Portland, Oregon, here in the States. Mm-hmm. And it was something like 150,000 year heat wave, right? It was completely not something that could have happened without climate change. I'd have to check that number, but it was something like that extreme.
Right.
And the point is that even the places that feel safe have unpredictable consequences waiting ahead of us, right? And that many of the kinds of things that are happening happen together, and both incrementally and in disastrous leaps, right? So, you know, we have just the steady thing of like rain falling at different times than it's supposed to, which could lead to, you know, problems with insects, for example, or stress on street trees, right? Or flooding, you know, that overtops the sewer system. Perhaps, for example, a record cold snap. Those are both realities that we have to plan for. And one of the problems with the idea of adaptation is that we still believe that we can leave our cities, our communities, our society more or less as it is, and bolt on a few solutions, a seawall here, you know, some street trees there, some cooling structures for seniors over there, and go on with business as usual. And what we should be waking up to is the reality that preparing for really massive climate and ecological impacts is now a core function of, you know, every city and community. And to put it mildly, that is not how most places are acting.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
If you are, say, somebody with power in a municipal government or, up here in Canada, a provincial government, and you're looking at a place like Toronto, but maybe also like Vancouver, which experienced the same disastrous heat wave that Portland did, it must seem so daunting to hear that and wonder, like, where do I start? If we're not just talking about some more trees or a levee, like, how do I start rethinking what we're doing in this city?
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is, in most places, municipal governance is not suited for the job it now has, right? In most places, municipal governance is seen as like the people who keep the water on and the people you complain to when your neighbor builds an illegal addition, right? Like, that's sort of the role that most people think their cities or counties or whatever have in their lives. And places, you know, cities talk about having, for example, climate strategies, but really those are just work plans to do some specific tasks. Sometimes they're decent, you know, sometimes they have some really good ideas in them, and sometimes they're totally lacking. But they're not strategies in the grand sense of this is how we're going to make a city that's going to thrive in the future, you know. And the designer Matt Jones has this line that cities are battle suits for surviving the future, right? That cities, they concentrate value in a way that makes them one of the few places that can actually afford to do what I call ruggedization, right? To really prepare for a range of futures in a way that creates more value as you prepare. But that's not the way that cities are set up to work now. And even cities that have sustainability departments or resilience departments or an adaptation committee or what have you are not talking about how we change the entire fabric of the city in a way that is more responsible given the threats we face and the opportunities we need to seize, right? So it's a tough, you know, it's a tough place to be in when your job as a, say, resilience officer is to catalyze some community disaster preparedness, and suddenly people are asking, what are you going to do about, you know, the potential of a killer cold snap?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a mismatched understanding of the role of cities. And I think that cities that move faster and are thinking bigger and are moving these questions more fundamentally into the operations of the city as a whole are going to be the ones that do better.
Tell me more about ruggedization. And in particular, give me some tangible examples of it, like things that it actually does.
Sure. So, you know, ruggedization has two parts. The first part is that we need to be making smarter investments. And smarter investments mean investments that reduce our risk of disasters on multiple fronts at once, right? So seawalls, to the extent they work, are great. But all they're doing is keeping your city from being inundated with a storm surge. You know, now if you live on the coast, mm-hmm. that may in fact be a very important thing to do, but they're a one-off, right? That's their only role. And, you know, it is slightly better, at least, to build wetlands there, because then you're at least getting some ecological benefit from that. It's controlling flooding, you know, but it's also helping to cool the city. There's various things that it does, various benefits, co-benefits, right? But fundamentally, we're going to need to start talking about all of these infrastructures that we've inherited from the 20th century, some cases all the way back to the Romans, right? And thinking about, is this the best way to do this thing, right? Is the best way to manage stormwater, for example, to channel it into giant, you know, giant pipes and culverts and send it to the ocean or the river or the lake that's nearby? Is that working? So the first part of it is thinking about making investments that return protection benefits on multiple fronts. The second part of it is creating more value as we do that. And one of the real problems that we have right now in cities is this idea that things really shouldn't change unless they absolutely have to, right? There's a tremendous amount of opposition to change in every North American city. And the fact is, many places are simply not valuable enough. They don't have the ability to borrow enough money to leverage enough public funds or whatever to make the investments they need to make. And so if they're going to make those investments, they need to create value, right? They need to attract new residents. They need to, you know, attract new industries or other ways of creating value, right? And so what we're seeing in Europe, where this stuff is being done on a much more competitive and intense basis, is these district solutions, right? Taking whole brownfield areas and building up, you know, a lot of housing, a lot of jobs, some industry, et cetera, and then using the money created by that new development to fund not only the ruggedization of that new district, but often, you know, connective ruggedization and bringing tax money into the coffers that allow us to, you know, invest in more sensible solutions throughout the city. And we're not doing very much of that in North America, right? There's nowhere that you could really describe as like in the middle of a giant building boom.
Unless you're talking about condos.
Yeah. Well, I mean, condos too, but even there, like the rates of building that we think of as being like, wow, there's just so much happening now, are historically extremely low. And almost every metropolitan area in the U.S. at least, that isn't actively declining, that isn't actively losing people, has a housing shortage now, right? And the places that are growing the fastest are places in the desert Southwest and on the Gulf Coast and so forth, where we really shouldn't be building much more, right? Where the conditions don't support a lot of further growth. So we have this fundamental need to build just a lot more than we have in order to be able to build systems that ruggedize across a lot of different parameters. And that includes being more efficient, being more sustainable, building green buildings, having distributed energy and water systems and so forth. All of these things help prepare areas to take less of a hit up front and recover more quickly.
You mentioned Europe being far ahead of North America in this respect. Why is that? What's different there?
Well, there are a couple things. Many European cities sort of started way ahead of North American cities, outside of a handful of North American cities, in terms of already being relatively dense, walkable, having good transit, and so forth. So the idea of adding additional dense development is sort of, it's not that big a leap culturally or politically from what they're already doing. They also have much smarter both regulations and government support for developing these kinds of areas. And finally, there's a sense of common purpose that really seems to be lacking in a lot of North American cities. You know, a lot of people in North American cities, because of the way we've set up, you know, home ownership and other things, their first concern is like, how does this affect my property values and parking availability, right? Not is this building the city my kids are going to need to have to live in, to survive and thrive in an, you know, in an era of unprecedented ecological upheaval.
What could we do here to change that? You know, this is going to take a massive amount of money and in particular investment from levels of government. And, you know, we've discussed the polarization in America on the show, but even up here in Canada, it can be really difficult to get governments to commit to long-term projects like this because they're going to be out of power in 4 years and, you know, be coming up for re-election. And all of a sudden they've spent hundreds of billions of dollars on this and it has nothing to show for it yet.
It's a tough question. And one of the challenges is that we really have to understand the idea of strategic return, right? We have to understand that what we're trying to do is create large-scale benefit for a lot of people, right? And that's simply not what government has been very good at doing in the urban form for a few decades now, right? There are a few cities that have really, that have done quite a lot. But by and large, I mean, you hear a lot the idea that like cities are built out, right? That like there's nowhere to build, there's nothing to do now. You know, the existing form is here and we just have to work with it. And I think we have to be seeing these changes as ways of creating advantage for a large number of people, you know, in order to get the political support that it takes to do this stuff. And we don't have that politics right now. What we need is a politics that is fast, right? That sees the both the ecological necessity of sustainability and the ecological necessity of ruggedization as top priorities and as things that that are best done as quickly as possible, where the return, the future we get is how fast we go, right? The return we get is based on how quickly we act and how far we can get before the real troubles set in. And that's just not the politics we have right now. And part of it is, again, that we continue to sort of prioritize the idea that that government in general is just here to provide services. It's not here to provide leadership. And we need, you know, we need a world where government is leading. That would really help us a lot. And where that isn't present, we need, you know, to look for the scales at which government can lead. And that might be cities. It might be that some cities really do a lot of work and mobilize the resources they need to ruggedize on a big scale, and a lot of cities don't. Unfortunately, I think that's the most likely outcome here.
Is this something that people in cities that have so far been mostly untouched by natural disasters will have to experience before they're willing to sacrifice what they think of as the normal operations of their city? You know, I'm thinking here of people in Toronto, obviously, but, you know, also Chicago, all sorts of cities that have not been impacted the way that Ida can impact the Gulf Coast or that wildfires can impact California. Is this something they won't realize until they're in it?
Well, this is the core idea of my book, The Snap Forward, and of the newsletter that I write, is that we are already in the time when we should be realizing this, that when we understand what is already true, right, what has already happened, we understand that we are behind the clock, right? That we're not yet ready for what has already happened. And that we undergo a process of understanding that we need to snap forward, right? That we need to change our understandings of the world very quickly to be in a realistic relationship with what's already true. And the problem is that that's a difficult process. It has a bunch of of barriers, you know, not least of which is that we all like to think we know what's going on, and we don't like to change our ideas. Very few of us are happy to right. like challenge our own core beliefs, right? But also we have to go through a process of compressed comprehension where we understand that there's been, you know, 30, 40, 50 years of change happening that we've only somewhat, maybe a little, paid attention to, that we haven't fundamentally been tracking. And now we need to suddenly catch up. And that is a very, that's a disorienting process, in part because if the world isn't what we thought it was anymore, right? If the world itself has changed, then our lives, the lives we built within that world, are themselves also changed, right? We no longer are living the lives we thought we lived. And that's, you know, that's psychologically challenging. You know, it's challenging to wake up one morning and realize that mm-hmm. you live on a world that demands massive action from you and your community and your city and your government in order to get the benefits that you took for granted before.
I hope we all snap forward very soon. Thank you so much for this, Alex.
Thank you.
You can subscribe to Alex Steffen's excellent newsletter at thenearlynow.com. That was The Big Story. For more from us, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. Find us on Twitter at thebigstoryfpn. Talk to us via email, thebigstorypodcast, all one word, at rci.rogers.com. Follow us, subscribe to us, whatever it is they tell you to do in your podcast player, do it and rate and review and tell your friends. Stephanie Phillips is the lead producer of The Big Story. Ryan Clark and Joseph Fish are our associate producers. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. Thanks for listening. Have a safe weekend. We'll talk to you after Labor Day on Tuesday.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together, and we were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.